Hello there, this is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, and on behalf of the entire team, we hope you enjoy the program. This is the Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. This hour, I'm broadcasting from WILL in Champaign, Illinois. We've been here for 2 days, and we are right on the campus of the University of Illinois. This is a historic place for a whole lot of reasons. We're learning all about it. It's a mecca for me, really, the first university program to include people with disabilities. Rolling around here in a wheelchair is nirvana, but it all started back in the 1940s. We're going to talk more about that this hour. The University of Illinois pioneered the development of ramped streets for wheelchairs. Every mom with a stroller needs to thank the University of Illinois. At about the same time, some even bigger geniuses built the first supercomputer right here at the university, the ILIAC. U of I has been a center of supercomputing ever since. They tried to reinvent the barn right here in Champaign back in the 1890s. The pioneering agricultural experiment station built the first round barns for dairy farming. They're still standing. You may have missed the round barn era, but Midwestern farmers know all about it. We've been learning all this during our visit to the University of Illinois campus and broadcasting the Takeaway from WILL in Champaign. For instance, we will learn about the work of 2014 MacArthur winner Tammy Bond later this hour, who's trying to save Earth's atmosphere from dark matter. Lots more in today's program, but we begin by talking about democracy here in the U.S. and in China. That's the sound of the fifth day of protests in Hong Kong, where crowds of tens of thousands of pro-democracy demonstrators are demanding electoral reforms and more autonomy for Hong Kong.
As a Hong Konger standing here in Wan Chai, I ask all of you from all over the world, please help us. Maybe all of you are born in democracy states. You are born with democracy choices. You have free election right, but we don't. Please help us. Please spread the news to all over the world. Please voice out for us Hong Kongers, as we really need democracy.
Video downloaded from YouTube, one of many videos there, one of many young activists behind the pro-democracy rallies in Hong Kong. Our next guest, Louisa Lim, could easily have been one of those voices. She's now a visiting professor of journalism at the University of Michigan and the author of The People's Republic of Amnesia, Tiananmen Revisited. Louisa Lim, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, John.
So what's your connection with Hong Kong? You have a long history there. You've been observing what's been going on. You've even been writing about it. Give me your thoughts.
Well, I grew up in Hong Kong, and I think that people who grew up in Hong Kong do really have a sense that Hong Kong has a very special and unique identity. After all, it was a British colony until 1997, when it was handed back to Chinese sovereignty. And at the time when it was handed back, Hong Kong people were promised a formula of one country, two systems, a high degree of autonomy. And I think that is really what's at the core of what's happening on the streets now. Young Hong Kong people are really standing up for that high degree of autonomy they were promised. They were promised the right to pick their own leaders in 2017, but the recent electoral reforms that Beijing announced really took away much of the opportunity for Hong Kong people to choose, and that's why people are so angry.
Do you think of yourself as a Hong Konger?
I do.
And what do you think the demonstrators want the Chinese government to do here specifically? And based on your experience of what happened at Tiananmen, what do you think the chances are of them achieving it this time around?
Well, the demonstrators would like electoral reforms. So Beijing had promised they could choose their own chief executive. But back in August, when they announced the electoral package, it was made clear that Hong Kong people would only be able to pick from two or three candidates, those who had really been pre-selected by a committee stacked with Beijing loyalists. And that really angered Hong Kong people. So for a start, they would like changes to the electoral system. But as these protests have built, the demands have also grown. I mean, on Sunday night, we saw riot police moving in against protesters. And now there's a real groundswell of anger against the current chief executive, Leung Chun-ying. And the protesters are also pushing for him to step down. I mean, the problem is that China does not like being pushed to decisions. And China's president, Xi Jinping, would not like to make any concessions that would make him look weak. So I think this is a really, it's a very difficult and dangerous moment, because really there's no easy path. You have either make concessions or crack down. And that's a very hard choice when you have that number of people on the streets that we're seeing.
Do you think that what's going on in Hong Kong right now is a message, one way or another, for the people of Taiwan, who possibly face some sort of reunification, unification, some sort of new relationship with China going forward, or the people of Macau? You certainly have heard lots of people watching what's going on in Hong Kong very, very closely.
Yes, I mean, it is being watched very closely indeed. And I mean, China has always wanted to reunify with Taiwan, which it sees as a renegade province. That's been one of its highest aspirations. And yet, as this trouble, you know, as the protesters took to the streets of Hong Kong, China's president was still touting this formula, one country, two systems, to the people of Taiwan, saying, you know, this formula would work for you. I mean, you know, now, of course, the people of Taiwan are looking at what's happening on the streets of Hong Kong. And I'm thinking, well, it's not working for them. Why would it work for us? So, of course, there is, you know, it is being watched very closely in the Chinese world. And of course, one of the things that worries the Chinese leadership the most is how it's being seen on the mainland. They just took the step of blocking Instagram, because the pictures, the photographs of these tens of thousands of young people on the streets send such a powerful message. And of course, the Chinese leadership is worried about a contagion effect. You know, if people inside China see this, what would happen?
Finally, what are the echoes, as you see it, of 1989 and the Tiananmen crackdown?
Well, I think what is very worrying to me is the type of language which is being used by the state-backed, the Chinese-backed press, which is really an absolute echo of the language used before the crackdown in 1989. The fact is that it's really almost as if they're playing from the same old playbook. They're talking about hostile foreign forces who might be behind the protests. And there are even kind of smear campaigns going around. So one of the 17-year-old student leaders was accused of having U.S. government ties and having, you know, having a black hand behind him that was manipulating him. And this is absolutely the same language that was used in 1989. And I think it's very, it's really a sign that China's government, they find the idea of Hong Kong people standing up for their own rights so hard to countenance, that it's really easier for them to kind of press the idea that there must be some kind of external force that is manipulating people, because that for them is, it's an easier message for them to spread. But I think the very fact that they're using this language shows how little they've learned from the lessons of Tiananmen.
Well, the old familiar language of counter-revolution there in China, as we look at what's going on the streets of Hong Kong. Veteran East Asian journalist Louisa Lim, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Louisa Lim is a visiting professor of journalism at the University of Michigan and the author of The People's Republic of Amnesia, Tiananmen Revisited. And the people of Hong Kong have a choice to make. Do they protest and confront the Chinese government, go down a road of history, Tiananmen Square in 1989, or do they simply continue with the ritual protests that end up on CNN and YouTube? What do protests lead to? That's what we're asking you. One of you in Minnesota writes, the protests in Ferguson, Missouri are giving Michael Brown's family a chance for justice and have prompted the inquiry to the Ferguson PD's alleged pattern of misconduct. More of you think that protests are ritualized in the United States and nothing ever changes. Call us with your view at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Be a part of the conversation. The Dixieland music of Jelly Roll Morton there. It seems as though Kansas City is the new home of the sports zeitgeist. The Kansas City Chiefs handed the New England Patriots their worst loss in more than a decade last night. A real Kansas City stomp, 41-14. One detail in the game was the penalty for the Chiefs player Hussein Abdullah, who knelt in the end zone in a Muslim prayer after scoring a touchdown. It was 15 yards. Huh? What? Thought it was unsportsmanlike conduct, that's what the ref said. Okay, no hard feelings, said Mr. Hussein Abdullah. There'll be more talk about that in Kansas City, but today there is even something more historic going on in Kansas City sports. October baseball may be back.
High pop-up. It is playable. Perez looking for it, and he's got it. And Kansas City, you are in the playoffs. First time since 1985. And the boys celebrate on the field.
Oh, yeah, Denny Matthews, the play-by-play man for the Kansas City Royals. That's from the Royals Radio Network. The often forlorn Kansas City Royals in the postseason. They'll be playing the Oakland A's tonight. If they win on this September 30th, October baseball. Lifelong Kansas City Royals fan, Scott Jarbo, how sweet will that be?
It'll be fantastic. You surprised me with the Denny Matthews clip. I listened to that maybe 20 times. You know, I grew up in the late 70s and early 80s when the Royals were fantastic and they had a big payroll and they had stars like George Brett and Brett Saberhagen. So to see them play well now is exciting, and to see the city excited about baseball in September is fantastic.
Can you compare this 2014 team with those teams of the 1980s?
Back then, when I was 11, 12 years old and a baseball fanatic, the Royals didn't have a lot of pop, and this year they don't have a lot of pop. They don't have anybody who hit over 20 home runs. They had a great pitching staff in the 80s with Brett Saberhagen and Mark Gubazon, Bud Black, and they have a great pitching staff this year with James Shields, but then also young guys like Ventura and Danny Duffy. So I think there's a lot of there's probably a lot of gutted out wins that happened back then, and certainly that's the case this year.
Who's given the team pop this year? You've got, fans who are, don't remember the 1980s, who are a very different, crew than was the case back in the 1980s. The city is very different from what it was in the 1980s.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know if there's one thing. In the sports arena, you're right. The Chiefs played well last night. The Royals are playing well. Sporting Kansas City, which is the Major League Soccer club, won the championship last year. There's all kinds of great energy. Oh, yeah, it's fantastic. And so there's a lot of great energy in Kansas City that hasn't been there for a long time. I left Kansas City in 1999. So between 1985 and 1999, there was a lot of malaise in the sporting scene. It's just really exciting to see it turn around.
Now, do you think you've got enough mojo to account for the loss of Lee Sung-woo, who's the Korean fan, who really is the lucky charm for the KC Royals, but he's back in South Korea?
Yeah, it's funny. When he was here, it was kind of fun to watch because he got treated like a king, which was fantastic for him because, he had certainly made a longer trip than just down I-70 to see the Royals. And they played really well while I was here. And then when he left, they kind of had a bit of a swoon, but I think they've picked it back up. I think they have as good a chance as anyone tonight. I went to that game in 1985 where the Royals clinched the AL West to go to the World Series. My dad took me for my birthday, and so I'm going to take my dad to the game today. It'll be a nice payback for years and years of taking me to ball games and playing catch in the yard.
He's a lifelong fan of the Kansas City Royals. He's making the trip from St. Louis, where he's lived since 1999, to Kansas City. Scott Jarbo, take care, good luck, and thanks so much.
Go Royals.
And we'll never be royals. Royals. It's the one in our blood. That kind of luck just ain't for us. We crave a different kind.
Now I want you to listen to a brand new song and see if you can recognize the vocalist here.
I'm still here, but yet I'm gone. I don't play guitar or sing my song.
If you guessed Glen Campbell, you are right. This song, I'm Not Going to Miss You, just released, might be his most personal after a lifetime of hits.
You're the last person I will love. You're the last face I will recall.
Oh, man. I am crying. This was written by Campbell for a documentary out later this month called I'll Be Me, that chronicles Campbell's final tour as he battles Alzheimer's and the descending darkness of dementia. Let's listen.
Not gonna miss you. I'm never gonna hold you like I did. I said I love you to the kids.
There is not a dry eye in the house at this moment. And John Schaefer is in the house, host of Soundcheck and New Sounds on our partner station WNYC. Welcome, John. What do you make of this song? This is amazing stuff.
It's a very, very interesting song for a number of reasons. John, if you hadn't told people about Glen Campbell's much-publicized battle with Alzheimer's, if anyone listening to this song did not know that backstory, they might think this was a breakup song, a divorce song, you know, someone saying, I'm done with love, I've been hurt too much, I'm out of here, I'm not even going to miss you. But it's knowing the backstory that really gives this song its little twist. There's a very barbed and perhaps unexpected and maybe gallows sense of humor in this song, because in the chorus he says, you know, you're the last face I'll recall, and best of all, I'm not going to miss you. That best is going to jar on some ears, I'm thinking, because he's walking a very fine line.
I listened to it. I looked at it, and he's literally right. He's literally right. And this
is
from the guy who wrote this 1967 hit, which I know you're familiar with. Listen.
It's knowing that your door is always open and your path is free to walk. That makes me tend to leave my sleeping bag rolled up and stashed behind your couch.
Now that's Glen Campbell singing Gentle on My Mind. Mm-hmm. Is that a beautiful narrative connection right there?
Well, you know, he will be known best for his narrative songs, not necessarily ones that he wrote, because, you know, Wichita Lineman, Galveston, some of his biggest hits were written by Jimmy Webb and other writers. But yeah, Gentle on My Mind was, kind of a game changer for Glen Campbell, turned him from an esteemed session man that only the musical, you know, insiders knew, into a kind of a household name, which he has remained for the most part ever since. You know, a couple of dips in his career over the years. But, we don't necessarily think of him as a songwriter. But this new song being billed as his last song ever, it's really got a lot going on for a song that is so sparse and so simple. And which, you know, again, is a kind of narrative of what he's been going through. It does remind me a little bit of one of his deeper cuts. On his Wichita Lineman album, he did a song called You Better Sit Down, Kids, which was written by Sonny Bono, which was somewhat controversial because it was about divorce. And a lot of the same language, you know, missing the kids, not being able to say goodbye to them, a lot of that is in that earlier song. So there are echoes here of classic Glen Campbell, if you listen for them.
Glen Campbell telling stories in songs. And as we talk about so much on this program, a song can carry a story, and it's certainly carrying a story here. John Schaefer, host of Soundcheck and New Sounds on our partner station WNYC. The song is for the documentary that will be released later this month called I'll Be Me, chronicling Campbell's battle with Alzheimer's. John, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
We noted at the beginning of this hour how this community of Champaign-Urbana with the University of Illinois has been a pioneer of disability rights since the 1940s, when the university offered a fully accessible program for people with physical disabilities who wanted to get a college education. First of its kind in the nation, and not without controversy. And more than 50 years later, the university is a center of disability education, competitive athletics, a world-class center leading the way on inclusion for people with disabilities. And in that tradition, some high school students here in Champaign-Urbana are exploring the rights for other kinds of disabilities besides physical in a new journalism project titled A Place in the Community.
People with intellectual and developmental disabilities in central Illinois have had to face a variety of challenges, from mistreatment and neglect in institutions to fighting for job and income equality.
That's the voice of Lara Orlandich, one of three student producers on this project. These students have been going into the community to find stories of how the legacy of stigma and shame have kept some painful secrets, secrets these students are uncovering as part of their project. With the help of radio station WILL right here, students are working with Janet Morford, who heads the Social Studies Department at University Laboratory High School, faculty sponsor in partnership with University High and WILL. Janet's right here in the studio. Janet, welcome.
Thank you.
So this is an ambitious project that really plays on a history of this community. How did you come to this whole idea?
Well, first of all, we've had this wonderful partnership with WILL for 20 years now. They understood that stories are powerful things, and that if you can pair up younger people with people who have stories to tell, that there's a lot of learning and synergy that takes place there. So over the years, the projects have developed. When I came on board in 2006, there was already the established tradition of having a one-hour documentary produced out of student-generated oral history interviews. Dave Dickey, my partner at the station, was the one that originally suggested the topic of working on inclusion in college sports. And so we looked at the parallel histories of people of color, women, and people with physical disabilities, which, as you've said, have a rich history at this university.
And you decided to focus on intellectual and mental disabilities, developmental disabilities, and the history that really is also centered here at the University of Illinois. Let's listen to a selection from the documentary that's still in process right now. Here are the voices of Uni High School student Gloria Ha, who's narrating here, and this is a story being told by Catherine Hammond.
Between 1907 and 1963, over 60,000 disabled individuals were sterilized in over 30 states. Due to stigma, parents usually chose to institutionalize their children with intellectual disabilities, and it was common for other siblings not to know that they had brothers or sisters living in institutions.
One of my brothers and I both did a fair amount of therapy, and that was one of the things that we talked about, the fact that we felt that we had this very safe, happy childhood, but all this time we didn't know that we had a sister and that she was growing up in a place that was not very safe or happy.
So how excited are the students about getting into this issue, and what are their discoveries? And use that audio there as an example.
The students are both daunted, but then once they get into it, they are very, very excited to make a personal connection with someone whose stories bring open all of the issues for them. Catherine Hammond had an incredible story of growing up and discovering only at the age of 12 that she had a sister, an older sister, who had been institutionalized since a very young age. And it was very telling of the kind of stigma and secrecy that surrounded the presence of people with intellectual disabilities in a family. Students identified with the 12-year-old Catherine Hammond and with her desire to understand how this could have happened. And that's what led them into understanding the deep history of institutionalization, the decisions of parents who bucked that institutionalization and began to educate their children at home and to push for services in public schools and gradually move towards the place where we are today, where people with intellectual disabilities do have a right to have a decent life in the community, not separate from others.
And, you know, this idea of stigma and a family secret is something I've experienced personally. I had an uncle who I discovered was institutionalized, my mother's brother, when I was a teenager. And this story is really about a collision of good intentions, but misguided science and misguided ethics on some level. How do the kids deal with that?
Well, they question it, but they also ultimately, I think they identify with people who want to belong, and all of us want to belong. And so they're able to identify with the interests of the person with intellectual disability who ultimately just wants to be part of the community. That's very much an issue for adolescents. They want to be a part of a community also. It really does push them to realize what it means to be human and the basic dignities that all humans are entitled to.
So, Janet, how's radio working out with a group of high school students who I suspect are just as facile with their smartphones as they are with a microphone?
They are, but we all discovered together that radio has a kind of pared-down simplicity that when you want to learn how to tell stories is actually wonderful. It requires that you think carefully about the questions that you ask, and it really teaches them to listen. National Public Radio has made a slogan of listening is an act of love.
Sure.
And we absolutely believe that. And there's some really powerful things that happen when students are taught and given the opportunity to just listen to other people's stories.
Who's learned the most in this project that you can name?
It's hard to parcel out the learning. I think there's learning on the part of everyone. The students certainly learn immensely, but the members of the community also learn. For many of them, this is the first time that they've told this story. Catherine Hammond had never before been interviewed about her family's story. When they tell the story and when it's heard and when it's validated by the questions and by the responses of students who are interviewing them, and then ultimately when it is put into a larger documentary, that's also validating. Members of our listening community also learn that these stories are also part of our history as a community.
The stigma attached to mental and developmental disabilities here in the community of Champaign-Urbana, it's something being explored by high school students at the University Laboratory High School with the head of the Social Studies Department, Janet Morford, who's been talking about a documentary project in collaboration with WILL right here in Champaign. Good luck, Janet. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Some thoughts now here at the end of the hour about dark matter. But it's not anything to do with physics. And this dark matter is well known. It's been detected. Everybody knows about it. Black carbon, the solid components of soot or smoke, comes from the burning of fossil fuels, coal, diesel, comes from forest fires, comes from cook stoves all over the world. Scientists believe black carbon is second only to carbon dioxide gas as a contributor to climate change. Tammy Bond is an environmental engineer and a professor at the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana. Earlier this month, she was named a MacArthur Fellow for her research unraveling the effects of black carbon in the atmosphere. Tammy Bond, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Welcome.
Thank you.
So let's talk first about your research. Black soot is pieces of carbon, like little pieces of coal and dirt in the atmosphere, and you're looking at it as particulates, or are you looking at it more in a chemical basis?
It is carbon that comes through the flame and arranges itself into the most amazing little structures. So it looks graphitic, but it's also in particles. So it's not pieces of the original fuel anymore. It is its own thing that only happens when it's very hot.
And what does it do when it gets into the atmosphere? Because I suspect it does cool once it gets into the air.
Well, it stays as a particle that's actually very resistant to being reacted or burned. And it, like most other particles, floats through the atmosphere. It interacts with clouds. And because it's black, it interacts with sunlight. It absorbs sunlight, just like any black thing does in the sunlight. And that radiation turns into heat that then heats the atmosphere.
And the MacArthur Award is really for your work in trying to get a scientific research body of knowledge applied to a source of black soot, which is not necessarily in the industrialized world. It's all over the world in cook stoves, in fires, in the developing world. It's an impact that is worldwide. Explain how your research might have an impact on people not in the industrialized world.
Well, one of the interesting things when you start making global models of soot or black carbon is that you have to look at everything. And a lot of the studies on emissions that have been done were focused in the industrialized world because they're large there. And when we started asking questions about where exactly does this material come from, we realized that there were a lot of things that had never been measured because they're not here. So we had to go to places abroad, measure cooking stove, we've measured brick kilns, we've measured diesel engines. And it turns out that the larger sources of black carbon right now are in the developing world. They've not yet gone through this fantastic transition that the U.S. did several decades ago, where everything was dirty and then we learned how to clean it up.
So as an environmental engineer, are there fixes? Are there remediations? Are there devices that can be put onto some of these brick kilns and wood stoves? And how would you go about actually making an impact in the developing world on all of these little sources?
Well, they're little and they're extremely numerous, and the fixes are both technical and non-technical. There are solutions in the developed world, we call them clean fuels. There are also things that you can do to make brick kilns burn cleaner, for example. And I don't think there's a magic silver bullet. The interesting thing about this challenge is that there are many solutions, and you have to look at each situation and figure out which one is appropriate.
Engineers love to design the really high-tech solution. In many ways, these solutions are low-tech. They have to be simple. They have to be understood by the people who are going to apply them. What kind of an engineering challenge is that? And it might not be your challenge, but someone's going to have to take it up.
I completely agree. And this is one of the really exciting things. I think that engineers can design anything given a set of constraints. So one of the things we have to do first is understand what the constraints are, and they're different in every place, whether it be rural, peri-urban, or urban. I also think that we'd like to believe that low-tech solutions can work, and in some cases they can. But in some cases, we also have to understand that we need to inject a little bit of bringing up the technology and also bringing the understanding to people on the ground.
So the investment is upgrading the cook stoves that are on the ground, as well as cleaning them up with low-tech solutions that will take care of what's coming out of the stack.
I would say low-tech or medium-tech. There are things that we know about combustion that simply need to be taught to the people that are designing stoves in these countries. And there's also a component of bringing cleaner fuels farther out to rural areas. That's how we solve the problem, after all.
So you've won the MacArthur, right?
Right.
I suspect you're not going to Disneyland.
I hadn't thought of that, no. Of course, everybody wants to know what I'm going to do with the money, including myself. I think one of the things I want to do is engage a little more in listening, because it opened up a space to not do just technical work. But when I'm actually in these countries, hear what's going on. Because I think as an engineer, one of the things we need in order to get better solutions is to really understand the constraints, understand the limitations. And as a researcher, very often you're limited by the amount of time you have to spend. And so I hope that I can use some of the freedom to expand the time that I have to engage and listen and understand.
So travel. You want to travel to some places where some of these pollution problems are actually happening and see what it looks like and listen to the people there.
I do. I already travel an insane amount. And so what I'm saying is I'd like to travel less insanely and perhaps more thoughtfully.
Where's a place in the world that you'd really like to explore with the freedom that the MacArthur might give you here?
Oh, there isn't a place that I don't like to explore. I work very closely with people in Nepal. I work closely with people in China. I love living in China. So I've been in East Asia and South Asia a lot lately.
Well, congratulations. And what do you think this does to you in terms of what's your obligation now? The MacArthur's have done this as a scientist and as a scientist who cares about the Earth. What's your responsibility now to justify this award? Do you have any feeling like that?
Oh, absolutely. That's a great question. My first reaction was to just say, well, I'm just going to plow it back into my lab. And then I realized that it's an incredible gift, an incredible responsibility to do the things that I can see that need to be done that couldn't otherwise get done.
Oh, it's beautiful. Tammy Bond, environmental engineer and MacArthur Fellow. She's a professor at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. We want to remind everyone how you can get involved in The Takeaway. Join our conversation. Get an early jump on all of what we talk about. Be a part of our listener response network. You can sign up one text a day. We ask you a question featured on the next day's program. Your voice becomes part of the on-air conversation. All you do is text the word START to 69866. That's START to 69866. Messaging and data rates may apply, and you can reply STOP to opt out. Thanks so much for listening, and thanks to everyone at the studios of WILL in Champaign, Illinois, for hosting us these past 2 days. I'm John Hockenberry, back in New York tomorrow. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Moo.com, offering business cards with Printfinity, the option for a different image on every card in a pack. More at Moo.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.